All right, everybody, you're listening to Philip Drew. We're joined on the phone by Ken Mayers. He's the chapter contact in New Mexico for the Veterans for Peace. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here. I can't make claim to all of New Mexico. We've got Santa Fe. There's another chapter down in Albuquerque. There's a brand new chapter up in Taos. And there are a bunch of folks down in Silver City who are trying to get one started. So the movement is spreading.
All right, that's good to know. How many members are there in Veterans for Peace around the country?
I don't know the exact number at this point because it's been growing considerably since the Iraq invasion. I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 at this point.
That's pretty good. Yeah, I learned about you guys at an anti-war rally, on February the 15th here in Austin. And a guy from the Veterans for Peace gave an excellent speech. And I just thought, you know, that's probably nobody has more credibility to be anti-war than people who have been there, right?
Well, it does give us a certain perspective that that most of our fellow citizens are fortunate to lack.
Yeah. Oh, and I'll explain to the audience, the reason that we have the Santa Fe chapter contact for the VFP here, I'm sorry, is that I had an agreement to interview a gentleman by the name of Dick Underhill, who is the Austin contact, but he could not do the interview. It turned out I had the time wrong, and when I figured out the correct time, it turned out he couldn't do it. But I talked with Mr. Mayers here, and he sounded like a great interview and definitely knows his stuff. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background in the military. And
I'd be glad to do that. Before I do that, though, I just want to also mention that some of your listeners may be familiar with another member of Veterans for Peace in Austin, Don Darling, who frequently does peace and justice programs on public access television down there. So they may have encountered him, whether or not he has been particularly announcing the fact that he's a member of Veterans for Peace down there. Yeah, as for my background, it's sort of funny because in some ways I'm a poster boy for the good things that recruiting people say. I had nothing but good breaks from the Marine Corps. But it was our government's foreign policy that I objected to. I went, Marine Corps put me through college, got me an engineering degree from Princeton back in 1958. I took a commission as a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. My first tour of duty was with the 3rd Marine Division in Okinawa, and came back with the 2nd Marine Division at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and then got transferred up to the National Security Agency for a year and a half. Before going to Chinese language school at Monterey. So, as you can hear, it gave me a chance to see the world and learn a lot of things that weren't in the school books.
What did you use your Chinese language training for?
Well, after Chinese language school, I went back to the Far East. I was a commander of a company of Marines that was attached to Naval Security Group activity that, among other things, was responsible for tasking the communications intelligence missions in the Asian coast, running from Vietnam, up the Vietnam coast, up the China coast, and Soviet Union coast in the Pacific. So in August 64, when a strange set of circumstances in the Tonkin Gulf led to the administration declaring that our ships had been subjected to an unprovoked attack, I knew that wasn't true. And it was at that point that I started thinking seriously about resigning my commission. And over the next period of the next 2.5 years, I had detachments of Marines in Chuai, Da Nang, and Phubai in the I Corps area of Vietnam, and became more and more convinced that we were on the wrong side in that war and that we were creating Viet Cong faster than we could eliminate them. So I resigned my commission and went back to the University of California at Berkeley to try to figure out how we got so screwed up. Got my PhD in political science without figuring out how we got so screwed up. And I would say to your listeners that about as good an explanation as one can find for why we're so screwed up can be found in Michael Moore's movie Bowling for Columbine. Because what that reveals is the way our culture is so dominated by fear. And this extends from the commercial level, from commercial product sponsors who are trying to make you afraid that if you use the wrong toothbrush, you lose all your friends, right through the fear that the current administration manipulated in order to justify an unprovoked attack on Iraq.
And so when you refer to that movie, you're not talking about the banning guns part. You're talking about the culture of violence.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the fact that I think in some ways the most telling sequence was when he crossed the border to Canada and goes into homes in Toronto where people don't even lock their doors because they're not afraid of one another. And Toronto is a multi-ethnic city, as American cities are. The gun ownership in Canada is even more prevalent than it is in the United States. But Canadians aren't afraid of one another. And our culture is one in which politicians, as well as commercial enterprises, manipulate fear in order to keep the citizenry afraid. And I think that, you know, back in 1933, I guess, after he'd been inaugurated as president, FDR said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." Well, we now have an administration who says we have nothing to offer but fear itself.
Yeah. Hey, you mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin and how you were there, and I'd like to ask you again, exactly what was your position at that time, and what was it that really happened, and what was it that they claimed happened?
Well, what really happened is still a bit obscure. My position at the time, I was a company commander of a company of Marines that was attached to a National Security Agency field activity in the Far East. And as I said, this activity was responsible for assigning the Communications Intelligence Commission, and this is what those destroyers were in the Gulf of Tonkin for. What they do is they would run up the coast frequently, actually in North Vietnamese territorial waters, in order to get the Vietnamese to turn on their radar so we could fingerprint them and to exercise their tactical communications so we could track them and figure out their order of battle and so forth. So that these had been going on for years. But at that point, the government was looking for an excuse. In retrospect, we now know the government was looking for an excuse to actually be able to launch bombing attacks on North Vietnam. This kind of comes out in the Pentagon Papers. And probably the best description of what happened at the Gulf of Tonkin is in Admiral Stockdale's book that he wrote a few years ago, and I can't remember the name of the book. But as he says, what happened was there was some... The radar operators encountered some strange noises, which they subsequently decided must have been due to the sea conditions at the time. So there was some preliminary indication that there might be North Vietnamese torpedo boats coming after them. They subsequently said, no, it really wasn't torpedo boats. I mean, meanwhile, they're firing at empty ocean. They went to general quarters. They were firing at empty ocean. And they subsequently decided, no, that was all a mistake. And they sent that information back to Washington, and the folks in the White House decided, well, we'll ignore that. We'll go ahead and use the incident to claim that we were attacked. You know, it was an unprovoked attack on U.S. naval vessels in international waters. And actually, they weren't in international waters anyway. So the whole thing was just virtually fabricated out of whole cloth. And Johnson went to the Congress and said, you know, you've got to give me the right to do anything I want to these folks. And the Congress rolled over and played dead, except for Senator Ernest Gruening of Alaska and Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon, who stood up and said no. But they were the only two with the guts to say this is nonsense. And the result can be read on the Vietnam Memorial in D.C.
Sure can. So what should the foreign policy of the United States be then?
Well, the foreign policy of the United States in its most general term should be one of using our incredibly vast resources to do good for the world, to really be the kind of moral leader that is within our power of being. I mean, we have the resources. We need to do it at home, and we need to do it abroad. So instead of enriching the arms manufacturers and giving tax breaks to the top 1% of the country, what we should be doing is finding ways of distributing our resources in such a way that promotes a sustainable economy here and a fair economy around the world. And it's our choice. I mean, it's something we can do. But to do that, we've got to somehow get our country back from the greed heads who have taken it over. And it's funny, I was listening to the BBC News last night, and they were talking about the current brouhaha in the European Union because of some comments that that Berlusconi, the president of Italy, made that was insulting to the Germans. And I said to my wife, you know the difference between Berlusconi and George W. Bush? What's that? I said, Berlusconi was a successful businessman. You know, so now we've got a president who failed in several businesses while enriching himself in each one. I think he is failing as president while continuing to enrich himself in that office.
No doubt about that. So I want to be a little bit more specific about when you talk about helping the world. And are you for so-called humanitarian interventions like what Bush is proposing to do in Liberia?
The Liberian one is an interesting case, and I will admit that I don't know enough about the facts on the ground. I know that the civil war has been going on for some years, and the probable cause for the civil war going on for some years is that different factions from Liberia want to be in a position to exploit the oil wealth that is off of their shores. It's been said that the oil deposits off of Liberia may be the largest ones in Africa outside of Nigeria. So once again, it appears that oil plays into this game, both in causing the civil conflict and in perhaps providing an opportunity for our current oligarchy to go in and enrich themselves some more. I think this is the kind of thing where we should be strongly supporting the United Nations. And if the United Nations creates an appropriate peacekeeping structure to go in there, I think we should be participants as requested. I think that in 1945, when the United Nations was created, this was a tremendous source of hope for a lot of the world. But since then, we've been using it when it's in our advantage to do so and trashing it when it's not. And, the most serious trashing probably was the recent trashing in terms of the whole Iraq nonsense. We should be supporting the United Nations and all its agencies. We should be supporting other international relief agencies. We should be...
Are you sure? Because aren't they the cause of all these wars? I mean, we just went to enforce UN Security Council Resolution 1441 in Iraq.
No, we didn't. The UN did not condone that so-called enforcement. We've distorted that.
That resolution was unanimous, and it said disarm or face serious consequences.
Yeah, but it did not say go to war. And it did, and when it, and we eventually refused to go for the vote because we knew the vote would go against us. And so we went to war without the UN approval.
Well, we went to war without the second vote, but they went ahead and said that the first vote back in October was good enough and that they were citing the UN resolution as their authority.
The rest of the world did not agree. And I think this is important. The rest of the world was strong. Who did we end up getting support from? Ukraine and Poland? Meanwhile, all the rest of the world is saying no, and 30 million people turned out in the streets the same day that you were turning out in Austin on February 15th. There were 30 million people in the streets around the world protesting the impending American invasion.
That's true, but they didn't cite the constitutional authority of Congress to declare war. They cited UN Security Council resolutions must be enforced. That's what the administration said for
What about the 60 or so UN resolutions ever since 1948 that Israel has been accused of violating?
Well, that's really my point. Is that...
No, in other words, but the point that I would make is the way we have used the UN is, well, we use it whenever we think we can claim something that supports us. We ignore it when it don't. So when they don't approve the actual invasion, we go ahead and invade anyway. But when votes go, you know, 100-something to 3 in the General Assembly, or 16-1 in the Security Council, condemning the destruction of Palestinian homes and so forth, we just ignore that. And we do whatever we can to block it. So the UN is a very imperfect instrument. What I'm suggesting is our foreign policy should be one in which we help to perfect that instrument rather than to weaken it.
Yeah, see, I always thought that if, I don't know, I think, you know, it's been so long since the American people really chose who their president was anyway, when both nominees are picked by the elite, and no matter who's in power, whatever humanitarian good purpose they might have for going out and enforcing UN resolutions or whatever, only make matters worse, like Bosnia, for example, or like the current roadmap where they're already promoting the idea of putting American peacekeepers with a UN peacekeeping force, or at least a NATO one, with American troops in Gaza and the West Bank. And this seems to me like the kind of entangling alliances that our founders told us to stay away from, that we should be friends with the world and not allies with any. I mean, you talk about, having a bunch of entangling alliances within the UN or with Great Britain or with Israel, it's all the same thing. It's all a system of alliances that guarantees that small conflicts become big ones and drag other nations that wouldn't have had anything to do with it into it.
Well, it need not be that way, and you know, the Founding Fathers had the luxury of being out of reach of any significant military power in the world once the British pulled out.
Well, we still are. We still are, aren't we?
Oh, no, not at all.
I mean, we can be nuked, but short of that, no one could ever occupy this land.
But no, but what they can do, for example, you know, it doesn't have to be militarily. You know that one-fifth of the American public debt is held by in foreign hands. If we continue to be increasingly perceived as the bully of the world, but people are going to say, gee, I think I'll stop buying these U.S. bonds because the future is not all that great for them. Then all of a sudden we've got a real economic crisis on our hands. We are entangled in the world. There is no way to avoid being entangled in the world. Now, what this suggests, I think, in the 21st century is that we really have to look at perfecting international institutions, like the International Criminal Court, you know, which we were going to join, but which the Bush administration has now withdrawn from. You know, I think looking towards the future, we really have to find a way to perfect, and when I say perfect, I mean continuously improve our international institutions rather than weaken them. Now, what this may mean, and you know, I think generally speaking, it's fine if one can avoid any kind of military involvement. But you take a look at what happened in Rwanda a few years ago, in part because we refused to support a UN move towards sending in peacekeepers. And there was, you know, hundreds of thousands of people slaughtered as a result that probably could have been prevented by effective international peacekeeping force. So that there are some instances in which a humanitarian peacekeeping force is appropriate. There are probably many others in which it isn't. But what we need is an effective international institution which can make those judgments. And they'll probably really screw up a lot in the beginning, but it's one in which we can learn and continue to improve. But
honestly, sir, I'm really shocked to hear you talk about the ICC and how we ought to be part of it. The Declaration of Independence is laying right here in front of me, and one of the complaints against the king is transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses. If our soldiers commit crimes, war crimes, in foreign lands, isn't it our responsibility to hold them to the rule of law here and to prosecute them here? Would you want to see an American tried in Brussels?
If we fail to try them, I do want to see them tried in Brussels. The ICC is set up exactly the way you suggested. That is, that the sovereign nations are responsible for that discipline, but if they fail to exercise it, then the international the criminal court will. And I think that's the appropriate way to do it.
Okay, but there's no trial by jury. There's no right to cross-examine your witnesses. There's no
The procedural guarantees. It's true that it's a trial by judges rather than a trial by jury, but the international procedures are very similar to ours in terms of the presumption of innocence, the rights of cross-examination, the rights of confronting witnesses, and so forth. And so I definitely feel that if we fail to prosecute our own war criminals, somebody should. I mean, that's the Nuremberg Principle, essentially, which we invented in 1945.
Well, I agree with you, in at least as far as if we don't prosecute our own people for war crimes, that they eventually will be prosecuted one way or another by somebody else.
And that's what the ICC said. I would take
the should out, but I definitely agree with you that we can't have it both ways, and that, you know, the international law can't apply to everyone else except us, and be while it's enforced by us. That can't work. But I would just say I would rather have, in that case, then no ICC rather than ICC that applies to American citizens being tried on foreign shores. And, I mean, I got the Declaration of Independence right here. It is the 4th of July. And these two complaints against the king are right here next to each other for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury and for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses. And I cannot imagine a system where some foreign police entity can come arrest Americans and take them off across the ocean. Now, we shouldn't be doing that to anybody else either, I don't think.
But we are.
Well, touche. Now, I would never disagree with you about we can't have it both ways. But I'm just saying, are we sure we want it that way if it's going to apply to us too?
You know, I will admit that I believe the future of the world is one in which we evolve towards increasing sound international institutions. I mean, you know, if you look at the evolution of political societies over the last, I don't know how many centuries you care to go back, what you find is that because of changes in communication and trade and all the rest, that our identity is increasingly broadened. I mean, at the time of the Declaration of Independence, those 13 colonies that became states thought of themselves as sovereign states. You know, they were not going into the federal structure we have now. They had a very weak confederation of sovereign states. But because of the increasing contact between the colonies, increasing trade, communication, and so forth, they saw the need for a more centralized authority, and our federal institutions grew out of that. And I think we're seeing the same sort of evolution on a global basis.
Right, but they wanted to have a common foreign policy to protect us with Europe, not to get us politically intertwined with Europe and allied with Europe.
Their concern at that point was simply to get rid of England, right?
No, I mean at the time that they made the Constitution and that they evolved their sovereignty to a more centralized role, like you're saying. That wasn't to get us involved in European affairs. It was to make sure that no individual state became involved in European affairs.
And it was actually fairly independent of the relationships to Europe. That is, that it was largely a commercial undertaking. It was because of the barriers to trade between the colonies and things like that. But they said, no, we really ought to do something that eliminates a lot of these barriers and makes us stronger on this continent and enables us to expand westward and a lot of other ambitions they had. And I don't think Europe was all that much on their mind at the time.
Well, there was a war from 1812 through 14 with England.
Yeah, but that came on, you know, more than a decade later.
Okay, so when you talk about the evolution, the the natural historical evolution toward more centralized sovereignty on a bigger and bigger scale and that kind of thing. What about the simple matter of checks and balances? And, obviously, we would both argue right now that there's no check and balance on America and that we're running roughshod, but if we just replace the all-powerful United States with a single military in the hands of the United Nations or somebody,
would it be the same way? Yes, it would, and that's not the sort of evolution that I would anticipate or encourage. Veterans for Peace has as its goal, in effect, increasing the awareness of the American people of the dangers of militarization and of imperialistic foreign policies, and trying to work towards peace and justice for all people. Here in the Santa Fe chapter, we say that we have three other goals, and that is to heal the wounds of previous wars, to minimize the suffering of current wars, and to help prevent future wars. And what we've been talking about for the last several minutes in terms of the evolution of international institutions, I think, is an important aspect in reducing the likelihood of wars, of being able to institutionalize international relations in such a way that it reduces the likelihood of wars. But
isn't going on peacekeeping missions, isn't that militarism too? I mean, we're still talking about heavily armed Americans walking around.
Well, not necessarily. You know, most of the peacekeeping missions that have gone on in the world have not involved heavily armed or other Americans. I mean, it's the Canadians and the Norwegians and various other smaller countries that have really carried the heavy burdens on the international peacekeeping and have done it in a way which has, in fact, been much more peace-oriented than the kind of interventions that we've been involved in. And provide a much better model than the kind of heavy-handed interventions that we tend to pursue. So that definitely, I feel that one of the things that we're struggling against, and a theme of our chapter this year, really, is that we are at a choice point. It's a choice between militarization and civilization. And if you look at the direction in which our current administration wants to take it, perhaps you're familiar with the blueprint for American domination, which is represented in the Project for a New American Centuries document. Now I can't think of that. That's funny. The name of the document is escaping me for the minute. But they laid out this blueprint before the elections. And what they've been following ever since the election is pretty much executing a blueprint for American military dominance of the planet for the next century.
Well, but isn't the argument of the neoconservatives just sort of Wilsonian doctrine only more so? Just vigorously exporting democracy instead of pussyfooting about? Beating around the bush?
You might be able to characterize it that way. Yeah, some people have definitely characterized it that way. It's sort of the, but it's not so much democracy as capitalism.
Well, state capitalism, at least. Yeah, that's true. I wouldn't call it free market capitalism when it's Halliburton getting a guaranteed government contract. Corporate profits, at least.
Yeah, it's free market for the little guys, and it's definitely not free market for the big guys. Just as years ago, Ron Bellums used to say, we have capitalism for the poor and socialism for the rich.
Absolutely. And see, it's always been my premise, and this is something that I was just talking about before bringing you on the air, is that where the American people went wrong was by demanding some socialism for them, too, instead of demanding an end for the socialism to the rich. And so now we've gone so far down this road where everybody's just bought off with one benefit or another, and nobody's willing to stand up against what you and I are currently agreeing about is this move into a total militaristic imperial state. And we're all such, whether we're big, rich white businessmen or whether we're the regular average folks around town, everybody's dependent on the federal government for one thing or another. And so nobody really wants to oppose it.
Well, I'm not. I'd have to think about that one a little bit. I think there are a lot of people who would like to oppose it, but don't have the faintest idea where to start, and we are currently still too fragmented in the ways we do try to work on it. I mean, you know, if we could get a line, for example, one of the things that could make a huge difference would, fairly simple thing, if we could develop the political will in the population to demand it, and that's the public financing of elections, to break the money connection between the corporations and the parties. But I don't see a way in the near-term future of bringing that about unless things get so bad that the American people are forced to wake up and see what's happening to them. Now, it's possible that's going to happen. Things seem to be getting worse in a whole lot of ways, but that, you know, I'd rather it didn't come from hitting such a low bottom that we're able to transform from the mud, in effect.
And unfortunately, that's usually the way it goes, is things got to get really bad before people wake up and realize they have to start paying attention and doing something about it also.
That does seem to be most common. But, you know, in the meantime, what we all need to do is work in our own backyards, in effect, and try to raise awareness when we can. For example, our chapter of Veterans for Peace has had a major public event every month but one since Veterans Day of last year. And these have generally taken the form of forums, either with or without a video, and then a panel of discussants and an open microphone period, and so forth. And these have been on various related topics. And we've been doing this, as I say, at a clip of about one a month since last November.
And
are getting...
I was just going to say, I ought to remind the audience, in case people are just tuning in, we're interviewing Ken Mayers. He's the Santa Fe chapter contact for the Veterans for Peace. So that's what he's talking about, the Veterans for Peace putting on at least one assembly a month, you said? Or
right.
One sort of thing?
Yeah, one public event a month. We've been getting tremendous support from the local community. Now, Santa Fe, of course, is a very unusual community. I think Austin is a little bit similar in some ways, although I'd be surprised if it was quite as, for the lack of a better term, liberal a community as Santa Fe.
Be surprised.
Well, I know it is. I mean, but you've got a mixed bag there, because on the one hand, you do have the university community. I know you've got a very live music scene there, but you also have large computer corporations and so forth. So you have more of a corporate environment there than we have here. We have a huge artistic environment here at Santa Fe. You know, it's a population of only about 60,000 people, but it sells more art than any other city in the United States except for New York and Los Angeles.
Oh, it's a beautiful city.
Yeah, so,
it's been a few years, but I love Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. Last time I went, I had a great time there.
Yeah, so it's an unusual community, and here, you know, three out of four bumper stickers will say no war. We just got back from vacation back east in Massachusetts, which is... one of the more liberal states in the union, and in 2 weeks we saw two decent bumper stickers. I mean, we were just shocked. It was good to get back here.
It really is all about bumper stickers, too, isn't it? Like, that really is kind of the measure of people's opinions, is what kind of debates they have on their way to work in the morning on the back of their car.
It is interesting, although I had a librarian friend who had a bumper sticker that said, "Read books, not bumper stickers." But it's true that you know, this starts to show that an idea is penetrating a community, and we have in Santa Fe we have a weekly demonstration at the corner of Cerritos and St. Francis, which you may remember is the biggest intersection in the community.
Is that where the big town square is?
No, it's not where the plaza is. But no, this is outside of the downtown, the heart of Santa Fe, but it's where two highways intersect, and so not super highways, you know, state routes. So there are about four, six lanes of traffic in each direction, And every Friday, there are upwards of 100 people out there holding anti-war signs and so on. And the significance of this, I think, is it tells people who are traveling their cars who may think, gee, I'm the only one who feels this way, that there are a lot of other people who feel that way. And bumper stickers are the same way. You know, as you start seeing more and more bumper stickers with a theme like No War, say, gee, you know, I'm not alone in this. Maybe we can do something about it. And then when an event takes place, people are more likely to go and learn more, and the momentum starts to build, and so forth. And, of course, the new factor in all this is the Internet, where people do have a choice of getting outside of the major media vendors, and I know that you have your own way of getting outside of the major media vendors. But this is starting to change the nature of the game as well, both in kind of the alternative communities, but even in the mainstream. When you look at what Howard Dean has accomplished in his campaign by effective use of the Internet, and you say, yeah, this is a significant change in the way communities can get impacted and start to learn alternative ways of doing things.
And that's so why apparently the Republicans and the Democrats are scared to death of the Internet and use every excuse that they possibly can to try to find ways to regulate and police it.
Yeah, I think that they're finding it really tough. It's kind of like a genie that's out of the bottle, and it's going to be real tough getting it back in.
I'm glad you brought up Howard Dean. I read the other day that he's more of a hawk on Israel than George Bush. What is with that?
I read that as well, and it's very disturbing. I've sent an email to my son in Vermont to ask him if he can give me more information on that, because I know he has connections in the Dean campaign, and to find out, you know, what's a complete story on this, because that's a very unsettling thing. I think it's terribly important at this stage that we get rid of the Bush administration, I think a lot of, particularly I know that most of our Veterans for Peace community here in Santa Fe, and I suspect nationally, are finding themselves in a real quandary, where Dennis Kucinich is the candidate who expresses views that are closest to our own. But at the same time, there's a feeling that Kucinich simply doesn't have the necessary moves, whatever.
Name recognition. In this room, people are making faces saying, who? Kiss
who?
What?
Is that right? Yeah, and the problem is, you know, we'd say we'd rather win with Dean than lose with Kucinich. But it's very disturbing what I've recently heard about Dean. We lived in Vermont when Dean was lieutenant governor. In fact, the first time he ran for lieutenant governor, we were very active in a movement called Beyond War. And he came down with the person running for governor at the time, Madeline Cunin, to give a political speech to the Beyond War group, along with Physicians for Social Responsibility. And Madeline Cunin gave a great speech. It was a real tub thumper. And then Dean got up and talked, and he was boring. And it was a small enough group, so you really had time to talk to him afterwards. And my wife said to him, you know, Howard, you seem to be a nice, bright young man, but you were boring. You've got to have some fire in the belly. You've got to show some passion. You're not going to get anyone to vote for you the way you came across. The next time he came down to Bennington, he was spitting nails.
So if he gets elected, I'll have your wife to thank. Is that it?
That's right. That's right. You'll have my wife to thank or to blame, depending on how he turns out.
I have a feeling it's going to start with a B.
But, you know,
and that's really the question is, how is Dean an alternative to Bush if he's only criticizing Bush for taking too long to send troops into Liberia?
Well,
the only difference of opinion they have is on Iraq, apparently.
Oh, no. Well, that seems to be his big foreign policy difference. I don't know if there are others in the foreign policy area, but domestically he is vastly different.
Has he said he'll repeal the Patriot Act or try to?
Yes, he does want to repeal the Patriot Act. He also has you know, in Vermont, he presided over the development of a program which guarantees health insurance to everyone under 18, and he's one of his major platform planks nationally is universal health care, although it's not single payer. I think he's chickened out on that one, but you know, he is an MD. He is much more aware of the problems of the health industry than George Bush, who doesn't seem to be aware of much of anything. And he's not beholden to any corporate interests the way the Bush oligarchy is. You know, and I think this is tremendously important, even the way he's running this campaign. You know, he's raised $9 million, and that's not from corporate contributions. You know, it's practically all from small contributors. So that he doesn't have the same anchors weighing him down that Bush does and that most of the other Democrats do. Now, Kucinich doesn't have them either, but he hasn't been able to figure out a way to raise $9 million. In fact, I don't think he's hit $1 million yet. And I think what was most telling in that respect was that the move-on primary, where Dean got, what, 44% and Kucinich got 24%, and that should have been a natural Kucinich constituency. If he couldn't win in that arena, you know, how is he going to win in a broader arena?
I ought to ask you, since you seem to know a lot about the Democrat race so far, how's John Kerry doing compared to Howard Dean?
Well, you know, Dean and Kerry appear to be tied in New Hampshire right now. And I know they're tied in Northern California. I think Dean is way ahead of Kerry in second place in the Iowa caucuses. So that I think Dean is looking quite strong at this point. I think if the and I don't know where Kerry's position is with respect to the other Middle East issues. One of the things, you know, when Kerry voted to support the war, Veterans for Peace nationally were just so dismayed because, I mean, here was a guy who was one of the founders of Vietnam Veterans Against War, who made that tremendously eloquent appearance before Congress, where he said, how can you ask someone to be the last American to die in Vietnam? And how could he turn around and support this war? We were all so dismayed. Whereas I think, had he voted against the war, he probably could have counted on the support of, oh, just rough guess, 90% of the Veterans for Peace constituency. But now it's a real quandary. And he, you know, when he campaigns, he says, you know, you should vote for me because I have all this foreign policy experience. I was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and it's on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Okay, if he had all that experience, why couldn't he see through this pack of lies that the administration was feeding us on Iraq?
Well, maybe he could see through the pack of lies just as easy as you or I or any five-year-old with an independent brain could look right at the lies. Maybe he didn't care. Maybe he really wanted the war. I mean, I don't give senators a, oh, boy, that senator accidentally made a mistake. I mean, you're a senator, you have to know what you're doing, and if you screw up, I don't forgive you.
Yeah, I may be a little bit more forgiving than that, but I generally agree with you. You know, and a lot of vets that I've talked to have said, you know.
I mean, this guy went to Yale. He's smart.
Well, so did the president. Going to Yale doesn't necessarily mean you're smart.
Well, it means you know each other.
Yeah, right. But actually, I think Kerry is smart, and that's why, you know, all the veterans I spoke to say, you know, if he can't explain himself a whole lot better than he has, how can we support him? On the other hand, I look at that. I'd like to hear what his position on Iran is. I'd like to hear what his position on Ariel Sharon and the destruction of Palestinian homes and targeted assassinations and so forth is. And I haven't heard any of that yet. I know where Kucinich is on all that, and he's on the right side of it. What I've heard about Dean so far is disturbing, but I haven't heard of any other candidates who are any better. Now, so we may be down to a point where our only choice is to vote for people who are largely rotten, but maybe at least would get rid of the Patriot Act. maybe at least would repeal this ridiculous tax break for the rich and do something better with that money, like supporting Medicaid prescription programs, so forth.
Didn't they just pass that last week?
Well, the one they passed is a smokescreen. It's awful. What it does is, you know, it does nothing in terms of reducing prescription prices. You see, if they'd gone through a prescription plan which was under Medicare, where the federal government then could negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for the cost of drugs under Medicare, then they'd have some leverage. But what they're doing essentially is subsidizing the insurance industry and say, yeah, you know, we're going to make sure that some taxpayer money gets added to some citizen money so that they can pay outlandish insurance premiums and get a little bit of relief, some of them, on their prescription drug policies. But what's likely to happen out of this one is that a lot of private businesses are going to say to their retirees, of which I'm one, oh, we don't have to pay you a prescription benefit anymore because the federal government's going to do that, which is going to mean a whole lot of people are going to be worse off than they were before. But it's, I don't know if you know, back in the 1890s when the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed, I think Marcus Hanna.
I know that when the Supreme Court said that Standard Oil was broken into 9 pieces, John Rockefeller laughed and turned to his boys and said, everybody buy Standard stock, 4, and hit the golf ball as hard as he could and laughed.
Yeah, and Marcus Hanna said, well, you know, we had to have a bill that we could go say we're going to do something about the trusts. Well, same thing's happening. Now we've got a bill that Congress folks can go home and say we did something about prescription drugs.
Right, but isn't it always that, I mean, I don't understand why you want to ask for a better prescription plan instead of, like, how about get the federal government out of the healthcare business, and then maybe we wouldn't have all these problems in the first place,
instead of
complaining about the details.
No, what we need is a very simple single-payer plan, like they have in Canada. People say, they've got socialized medicine. No, what they've got is they've got private medicine, they've got public financing. And, you know, you take a look at, we've got the best health care in the world for the rich. But if you're not rich...
Well, and the Canadian doctors all come here for their surgery.
So, well, some do and some don't. One of the things that happens as a result of their, an essentially democratic approach to health care is that the rich can't jump to the front of the line. If they come to the United States, they can jump to the front of the line. But if we had a single-payer health care system, it would be very different. I mean, right now, 25% of our health care dollars go into insurance administration and profit. Has nothing to do with health delivery.
Absolutely. Well, let me ask you this. What year did you say it was they passed the Sherman Antitrust Act?
It was back around 1890 or so.
About 1890 or so, that's what I was thinking. In the 113 years since then or so, have they ever passed a good antitrust act that finally got it right?
Well, there were some improvements in the 30s under the conditions of the Depression, somewhat transitory, and you know, how good an act is depends largely on how well it's enforced as well. But there were some improvements in the industrial legal structure in the 30s. There were some improvement in laws affecting safety and health. I mean, like OSHA is an advance to the extent that it's allowed to do its job. Reduces workplace injuries. But, you know, in the decade, let's see, let me think if I can remember the facts on this one right. I think it was in the decade of the 1920s. There were 25,000 workplace deaths a year. So in any 2 years of that decade, you had virtually as many workplace deaths as we had battlefield deaths in Vietnam in 10 years. Because of the structure of our industry and the lack of protection for workers. But, you know, this is all stuff that interests me tremendously. It's not something that veterans have a particularly advantageous perspective on relative to the rest of the population.
I know we started out talking foreign policy, but I figure this is a good enough debate. I figure go ahead and keep it going. There's no reason to really stop you. I don't know what else to ask you about foreign policy at this point. So.
Well, I think, you know, I think that we agree generally on the foreign policy issue that America should not be the bully of the world. And what's really disturbing to veterans is, I think, I won't say to veterans generally, I'll say to Veterans for Peace as an organization, members of an organization that has a particular perspective on based on our years of service. Is this kind of chest-thumping pride that Americans take in the flag waving and all that, which is so empty, because they don't say the flag imposes a responsibility on us. We have an opportunity. The structure of our country gives us an opportunity to be a responsible part of the world and to use our resources responsibly. And in so many ways, we seem to be becoming increasingly irresponsible, and that irresponsibility is going to be leading to the creation of a lot more veterans. One of the things that Veterans for Peace would like to see is a whole lot fewer veterans being created.
Absolutely. What did you think when you saw George Bush say "Bring 'em on" the other day?
You know, he's like a 14-year-old with testosterone poisoning. I mean, it's just this macho crap. Here's a guy who was AWOL from the National Guard. You know, he never even showed up for drill for a year and a half. He flies off to the deck of an aircraft carrier and says, "Boy, I sure miss flying." So why didn't he show up for those drills when he would have had a chance to fly all those weekends?
It makes me wonder, how does he impose that fake Texas accent over his natural Connecticut accent?
So well,
he's got to really work on that. Well, I imagine a team of linguists following him around all day, reminding him to call everybody y'all.
Well, his father grew up in Connecticut, but he actually grew up in Texas.
No, he didn't. He
around
went,
Midland. He went.
He
went off to prep school. Yeah,
he
yeah. Then
he
went off
high,
to prep school.
Right.
Yeah, but you know, he spent years, and then he's just hung out in Texas since then, getting subsidized by his father's rich oilman friends and so forth. But yeah, I think everything about him is, well, down deep he's shallow. You know, I think he's phony as a $3 bill, and the accent, I suppose, is, I don't know how genuine the accent is. It may be part of the phoniness, or may be the one genuine thing that's left.
Yeah, interesting question. Maybe junior high is that formative accent years, and the rest of your childhood and adolescence and college years spent in Connecticut are irrelevant to accent creation.
Well, you know, when I listen to him speak, which I'll have to admit at this stage I generally avoid doing, it sounds like he never left junior high school. He probably doesn't know anything more about the world than he did when he was in junior high school. And he doesn't know anything more about mature behavior than he did when he was in junior high school.
Well, what do you say to the people, because I'm sure there are people in this audience going, well, but I think that George Bush is a good man, and he's a lot better than that despicable Bill Clinton, and he's a good Christian, and he's an honorable straight shooter. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's almost beside the point. I mean, Bill Clinton... To me, Bill Clinton, in a lot of ways, was a very disappointing president. In some ways, more disappointing than George Bush, simply because I think Bill Clinton is a very intelligent person. He's a very knowledgeable person. He knew better, and so he should have produced better. What he did, you know, in his own way, he didn't leave junior high school either. He wouldn't have gotten in the trouble he did. But you take a look at, for example, he exercised bad judgment in a real estate deal that ended up costing him $40,000 and ended up costing the American people $50 million to investigate. And then you take a look at all of the shenanigans, business shenanigans that George Bush has been involved in, and he gets a free pass.
So can I ask you again, Mr. Mayors, how old are you? Is that okay? I don't mean to...
fine. 66.
Okay, 66. So is it true then for us who were only born in the 70s, is it true that back in the day, if, say, for example, I don't know, Harry Truman's former company had gone and rebuilt all of Western Europe, wouldn't that have been a scandal?
Yeah, I mean...
to say the least, I mean, wouldn't that... I mean, the fact that Halliburton has all the deals in
it's outrageous.
Iraq while their former chairman is the vice president...
And still getting money from them, it is simply outrageous. But they get a pass on this.
But back in history, though, this would have been something that people would have been absolutely outraged about, though, right?
I'm not sure if they would have been outraged or not, tell the truth. The Marshall Plan was probably the most brilliant piece of foreign policy any nation has ever developed. The rebuilding of Europe in the late 1940s. Absolutely brilliant. And it was also good for America, because Europe didn't have the capacity to build the things that were needed in order to rebuild Europe. And so we shipped essentially $17 billion to Europe, which they turned around and spent in the United States. But it wasn't a no-bid contract with a presidential crony.
Yeah, it seems like even when I was a kid, things like that would have been at least covered up. They wouldn't have just straight admitted that their old company got the contract.
Yeah.
They would have at least lied about it. I mean, come on.
Yeah, well, there is no shame. But so going back to your question about what do I say? People say, well, George Bush is a good man. He's a good Christian. To me, it is not Christian to go and lie to the Congress, send your Secretary of State to lie to the UN so that you can go and bomb the hell out of a country which is no threat to you. To me, that's not being a good Christian. And being a good man, it is not a good man to me if you take an oath on entering the National Guard and then fail to show up for drills for over a year while thousands of Americans are being killed in Vietnam, every year. It's not a being a good man to use your parents' influence to jump you over a whole bunch of people on a waiting list to get into the National Guard so you don't have to go to Vietnam. That's not being a particularly good man. It's not a good man to have had to refuse to own up to your own personal behavior more than 10 years ago. I'll let you know. I've been drug free for 10 years or whatever it was. But no, I'm not going to talk about whether I took cocaine 11 years ago.
And yeah, never mind all the people who were imprisoned while
the
governor of Texas on cocaine charges.
That's right. That's
I'm sorry, sir, Mr. Mayors, we are simply out of time.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
I really appreciate you coming on the air.
Well, glad to do it. I've enjoyed the discussion.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ken Mayors. The Santa Fe chapter contact for the Veterans for Peace.
It is my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply.
Good morning, Agent Johnson. The film you are about to see is top secret and contains adult situations. In 1945, the people of Europe struggled to rebuild following the war. To ease this crisis, President Truman promised relief.
American tax dollars will help our allies who fought so poorly and surrendered so readily.